Can you hear me now? Okay. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to all. My name is Debbie, and I am an alcoholic. Stand up. Our fifth tradition states that our primary purpose is to carry the message to the alcoholic who still suffers. Valley Group honors this tradition by rigorously searching for the finest recovery speakers in the Western Hemisphere so that they can share their experience, strength, and hope with us each week. We recognize one of these speakers for their service to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. It is now time to recognize Valley Group's Outstanding Speaker of the Week. The nominee for this category has a sobriety date of June 30th, 1988. He has been continually in service as H&I representative, GSR, and sponsorship. And he also has been involved in the communities of Fresno and Visalia. And the moment we've been waiting for, might have the envelope, please. Woo! I'm so nervous now. I do it like on the stores. Okay, the winner of the Outstanding Speaker of the Week award is Danny S.
You should have brought a date. Oh, thank you very much. My name is Danny, and I'm an alcoholic. And who would have thought that the more you fucked up, the more awards you get? Huh? I mean, think about that. And only here in this place, the Ice House, you know, the home of the Creative Center, is one of my favorite parts of Visalia. Yeah, my name is Danny Shakwa. I'm an alcoholic, and it's really pretty easy for me to say my last name today. You know, it wasn't so easy a long, long time ago. You know, in fact, you know, with all the awards we gave out and all the chips and the announcements, I've been told I only have 2 minutes to talk, so I'll make this quick here. But I remember the first time I was sentenced to a meeting. It wasn't an AA meeting. It was the other program that starts with an N and ends with an A. And I'm glad to see, you know, people that I know. You know, there's a lot of people in here that probably recognize me from going to Pine Vision, Wuthering Heights, and all those places. And you know, the first time I went to a meeting, actually, I didn't even know anything about 12-step recovery. All I know is that I showed up to work at a state hospital, and this was back in 1984, I think, or 85, and I was loaded. I was under the influence, and I thought that I was hiding it pretty well, but not from one of the patients in the state hospital who turned me in. And, you know, that was pretty embarrassing. I mean, I was the helper, right? You know, I'm the one that gets paid to be there to help the helpless. You know, here I have, you know, somebody that's helpless, you know, going to my supervisors and saying, you know, you need to do something about Danny there. You can't even, you know, keep his head up. You know, so they sent me to an NA meeting in San Luis Obispo. And, you know, I went there. It was at the Alana Club in San Luis, and that's how I used to live over there. And it took me, you know, I was supposed to go to 5 meetings or something, you know, just kind of much like a the nudge from the judge that I know some of you guys are familiar with, you know, but I had to do certain things to kind of get the state hospital off my back. You know, it had nothing to do with that I thought I had a problem or that I was going to stop drinking or using drugs or doing all the other deleterious things that I was doing. That's a fancy word for meaning bad shit, you know. But a friend of mine who I had as a roommate was a recovering alcoholic. And I saw him drinking, and I was really glad he was a recovering alcoholic because he was just a mess. He was worse than I was, and those were the kind of people that I used to like to use to compare my drinking to. You know, I never compared my drinking to people that didn't drink or did it normally. You know, I didn't really spend too much time with those kind of people. But I went to this meeting because I knew Rod would be there. And I was just, I didn't know what the feelings were back in those days. I've kind of learned being in AA and becoming more self-aware about myself since, you know, what certain emotions are and how they feel in my body when I feel them and how to identify them and stuff like that. But back in those days, I knew angry and I knew horny and I knew sad. I didn't know things like fear of being afraid or being ashamed or being embarrassed. I mean, if I got embarrassed, which I knew I felt, I'd get mad. That's how I knew that I was embarrassed, or other people did. You know, so I was embarrassed, and I was ashamed, and I was being sent to this place where I just thought was, you know, where they housed losers, you know? And I remember walking into the Alana Club looking for Rod, and of course, I didn't go in there, you know, my name's Danny. You know, I'm an addict, and I need to be here. I got caught at work. I went in there going, oh, I'm just looking for a friend of mine, Rod. You know? And they were like, sit down, have a seat. You know? And I was like, okay. You know, I didn't know that they knew, you know, that that was kind of a common just piece of bullshit a lot of people have when they walk into a place like that. They were kind. They offered me a cup of coffee, and they offered me a seat. And, you know, it was in a circle. And I didn't see Rod, but the meeting started. I heard people start talking. And I thought, well, you know, it'd be rude to leave right in the middle of this. After all, I am the visitor here. So I stayed, and what they did was they went around the circle. I'll never forget this. It was like it was yesterday. And everybody said who they were and said the sobriety date, much like you guys did when you walked up here. And when it got to me, I said, my name is Fred. And I'm just here looking for my friend Rod. And, you know, it wasn't the first time I got that, you know, rolling the eyes back in the head look from people. Because, you know, my family had given me that look for a long, long time, you know, and my girlfriends had, and people in my life. I mean, I knew the look. The look, the you're so full of shit look. You know that look? Okay. And they were giving me, and so I was thinking, God, I'm really, really in the wrong place. I'm with a bunch of losers who are judging me and giving me this really, you're so full of shit look, you know? And I just couldn't wait to get out of there. So as soon as it seemed like the meeting ended, I stood up out of my chair and I just bolted across the room and I opened up a door and it was a closet. So I close the closet door, I back up, and all of a sudden I've got these like 30 or 40 guys standing around me in a circle holding hands, and I'm like right in the middle, you know? So, you know, I learned very early that like the more you resist something, the more it comes to you, you know? I didn't go back for a long time. I thought, you know, I'm not going to go back to this meeting again. They're certainly going to recognize me as the buffoon from the Tascadero, you know. So I hopped around, I think, to different meetings in different towns over in San Luis Obispo area, which you can do pretty easily. You know, I used 5 different names, never used Danny once, you know. And, you know, I slowed down my using. I'm not going to do it at work anymore. You know, them funny left-handed cigarettes, those were some of my favorites at that time, you know, because I was holding on to the beer with my right hand, you know, and I'm not going to do it at work. I've done all the things that over the years that I've learned, reading out of the book of Alcoholics Anonymous, that there's a whole bunch of people like me that tried. Switching from one drink to another, from one drug to another, not drinking during work, you know, but I mean, of course, my work was affected by my drinking because all I did was think about getting off of work. And the whole second half of the day was spent, I can't wait till 5 o'clock, I can't wait till 5 o'clock, you know? And, you know, this was a pretty, you know, telling time in my life, really, because at this particular time, and I'm going to back up a little bit, because I didn't come in here prepared. The more I do that, the more lies I tend to tell, you know, but this was a pretty important time of my life because I had some of my friends that were also drinkers, drug users, start looking at me and saying things like, dude, I think you need to do something. And I always responded with, you're telling me that I've got to do something? Are you kidding? I mean, go look in the mirror, dude. I mean, you're really fucked up. You know, you're really sick. You're really this. And I found myself just constantly defensive. Constantly. You know, and I know now that the look on their face at the time indicated that they weren't doing it to hurt me. They weren't doing it to punish me. They weren't even doing it to put me in a really awkward position. They were doing it because they saw something that I couldn't see. You know? I mean, I think it's, you know, I've heard in meetings over the years that I've been going regularly without drinking, I've heard that there's, some people refer to this, not in the book, but there's a zero step where everybody else thinks you're powerless over alcohol, except for you. You know? And I was quickly getting to that point. You know, my family, my mom and dad knew, you know, because I would do really dumb things. You know, now I'm 58 years old, you know, so one of the things that didn't happen to me is I didn't get arrested and get sent out to prison. Didn't get DUIs. So I got arrested when I was a 17-year-old, you know, for drinking in public. You know, but after that, I mean, it was a very different time. I fully, you know, anticipate that if I were a youngster today drinking the way that I drank back then, I probably would have lots more wreckage. Because those were the days where they used to just kind of drive you home. You know, if you're as old as I am, you remember those days. I mean, it was just different. It was so different, you know. And the truth of the matter is, being a man, you know, I'll go back a little bit. You know, I'm Italian. Grew up in Catholic schools, 11 and a half years of parochial school. The second half of my 12th year was spent at a continuation school in Fresno. Because of my drinking. You know, and my grandfathers were both gentle, great men. In fact, my mom's dad was probably and will forever be the biggest hero I've ever had in my life. His name was Jacopo. Jack, and he came from Italy, and he came with, you know, a branch of a grapevine, you know, that his father had given him, and he migrated all the way to Sanger, worked as a migrant farm worker for a long, long time until he could scrape enough money to buy a little vineyard, which he started, and him and his brother Corrado started a winery. And, you know, my dad, like, I'm an abnormal kid who came from an abnormal family, you know, and tried to be normal. Try to make sense out of that. Okay? Never worked. But my grandparents would rescue me every once in a while, and I knew that later. Not at the time. I thought I was just going over to the ranch to play in Sanger. But they would rescue me from a pretty violent place that I was living at home. And I spent all my time with my grandpa. And I remember him and his brother Corrado, you know, making wine. And I was a young kid, and I don't remember getting drunk, nor was it even my intention to get drunk. But I remember them giving me some wine. And I would get a little dizzy, I think. I don't remember it specifically. But I do remember something really, really important that continued to go with me for the next 10 or 12 years. Is I would get a little bit tipsy. They were really, really drunk, and they would start dancing these Italian dances. Okay? And I would get out there and I would twirl around and I would act like a fool and I'd fall down and they would belly laugh and slap me on the shoulder. And I tell you, for the first time, I really felt like I was a part of something really big. I had these two mentor Italian men that were patting me on the shoulder and showing me that I was important. And, you know, so I learned, you know, from a very early stage that there was something pretty special about this drinking thing, right? That I got some kind of attention that I wasn't getting in Fresno at my dad's house. And, you know, my grandfather was just a typical alcoholic that you read in the book. You know, he was Italian, never learned to speak English. He was a great farmer, never got a driver's license. But, you know, me and my grandmother would frequently go looking around Sanger to find his tractor, you know, parked in front of a bar, you know. And I remember we had my grandma, we called her Nani, you know, that's Italian for grandmother. But Nani had this pink Dodge with those big fins in the back. And she was like 4'8". You know, we would drive around Sanger, and she'd look through the steering wheel, and there were about three bars at the time, you know, and invariably we would see Nano's tractor, and it was parked just perfectly right in front of the bar, and Nani would go in, and he'd come out, and she'd have him by the ear, throw him in the car, and they'd yell and fight in Italian all the way home. And then I remember, you know, Nani going through the house and finding all these bottles of booze that my grandpa had hid all over the place, and he would get in trouble. You know, so at a very early age, I'd learned that it wasn't so much drinking that was the problem here. It seemed getting caught was the problem to me. Right? And somehow, you know, Nano seems like a really good guy here until he gets busted by Grandma, then all hell breaks loose here. You know, so something's going right. Well, you know, he died as well as my other grandfather at age 60 from cirrhosis of the liver. Both of them, 60 years old. Dead. Liver disease. Neither one of them had ever had a DUI. Neither one of them had ever been arrested. Neither one of them had ever done anything other than drink on a daily basis, and eventually the alcohol handed their body a price tag. Okay? And, you know, the interesting thing about that when both my grandpas died was nobody in my family ever really talked about it being alcoholism. Okay? They kept that a secret, much like I kept myself a secret when I walked into that NA meeting for the first time. There's something shameful about this. There's something wrong about it. You know, losers. This happens to losers. And that would just haunt me. You know, well, you know, I'm going through my teen years, and I think I was right about the time when my grandpa died. I went out drinking with a bunch of friends in high school, and I stole a bottle of vodka from my dad. You know, and I never drank anything other than wine or beer. You know, but this has been, I was with the big boys this night. you know, the popular guy, stole a bottle of vodka. By the way, the bottle of vodka turned out to be a bottle of vodka that my dad bought in Russia when he was in the National, not the National Guard, but the Coast Guard, in World War II, that he was saving to drink with his buddies, you know, after they celebrated 30 years of being out of World War II, right? I didn't know. It was dusty. I thought he didn't want it. It was dusty, right? So, but I never drank vodka before, you know, so I'm drinking this stuff, and I don't know if any of you guys remember the first time you drank something other than what you were used to. I was just drinking and drinking and drinking, going, what's up with this stuff? It doesn't work, you know? 3 days later, you know, that night I did tons of damage, you know, to houses. I was with friends. I got arrested. You know, of course, I was left there for 2 days. I was the only shop would ever be arrested. I mean, all hell broke loose. I got kicked out of the Catholic high school that I was going to. You know, I got sent over to this continuation school, you know, where they send, remember Pinocchio, where they send the boys that become donkeys? Okay, that's what DeWolf was like back in those days, right? So there, one more time, I'm the boy that's getting sent to DeWolf to become a donkey because I'm a loser. I mean, you would think that was the first big drinking episode that I ever really had. I drank here and there with my grandpa and with friends a couple of beers. I mean, I did the 2 Bush beers and go to the dance and lose all my inhibition, ask girls to date stuff, you know. I mean, I did that, you know, but this is the first big, I'm going to go out and I'm going to get drunk. And, you know, after it all was said and done and I was just full of shame, you know, I went, they gave me a chance to go back to this high school. Even though they withdrew the chance after a couple of days. But I remember just being scared to death, and I think that's what they were hoping for. I walked into the high school. I drove into the high school, actually, my old 63 Dodge Dart. I was shaking, and there was so much of me just wanted to turn my car around and get out of there because I was pretty certain that everybody was going to judge me the way that my family had judged me and all my family, you know, relatives and stuff like that, the only shoplifter that's ever been arrested. But a funny thing happened that day. As I pulled my car into the parking lot, and I parked, a whole bunch of my peers walked towards me, and I just thought, well, they're just going to tell me what a loser I am and how stupid I am and all that other stuff. And when I got out of the car, they did just the opposite. They were kind of like, cool, Chakwa, you got arrested, dude, that's so cool, you should have seen you, you know, that boy. God, it's a blessing that iPhones weren't around back then, you know. I mean, you know, but again, just like I learned with my grandpa, something really important happened. I did something really bad. I got in a lot of trouble. It cost me and my family a lot of money to repair the things I broke that night at this drive-in theater in Fresno where Macy's now is. You know, and I went away from that going, I like it that they think that way about me. I like it. Somehow I started developing this identity as like I'd rather have the way they think about me than have to deal with the way my family thinks about me right now. So I started drinking more. And I drank on a pretty daily basis. Used lots of drugs. I mean, I'm a product of the 60s. I'm not going to get specific. I know this is an AA meeting, but the truth is I'm not an alcohol-specific type of person. Okay? It eventually became my drug of choice. You know, and I used it because it worked for a while. It changed the way I felt about myself. All of a sudden, you know, I was an abnormal person or a kid that came from an abnormal family, and somehow drinking a certain amount, a little bit of cocaine, 2 hits of a joint, 1 Quaalude, I was perfect. I was perfect. There was like this pharmaceutical mix that I could do where it's like, this is it. This is it. This is that place. And for the next 15 years, I just kept walking through my life trying to duplicate that moment. Okay, and I see a lot of heads nodding up and down, so my guess is I'm not the only one in this room that remembers that feeling and remembers being able to always missing the mark, right? We always miss the mark, you know, and of course I never missed the mark under the mark. I was always over the mark. Continued to get in lots of trouble, you know, washed out of school. I tried college a whole bunch of times, you know, and I was one of those guys. I was the typical, as they say in AA, I was the 100-yard dash man or 50-yard dash man in a 100-yard race. You know, started off real strong, backpacks, brand new books, 18 units. I'm going to kick ass this semester, right? 4 weeks into it, I'd miss a test. My mom would die, you know. three times, I think it was, in one class, you know, and I did all these things that I continued to be ashamed about and sweep under the carpet. The more I swept it under the carpet, the more shame I developed, the more embarrassment I felt, and the more I drank, you know, and the less I hung out with people that did normal things. I was an abnormal kid that grew up in an abnormal family that wanted to be normal. All of a sudden now, I'm living an abnormal life with abnormal people still trying to be normal. I was getting further and further away from what I thought was normal all the time, even though a guy named Jim, that's a friend of mine in AA, told me that normal was a setting on a washing machine. He told me that a long time ago, you know. You know, but I didn't know that then. You know, and all I just wanted to be important, and I wanted to not have to lie anymore. My life was filled with lies. I remember going to bed, and I meant it. I meant that, God, if you get me out of this one today, I promise I will never lie again. And the truth is when I go back to those times when I said that, yeah, I was trying to get out of being jammed up and get out of some trouble. But when I prayed to this God, whoever it was that the priest taught me about when I was going through school, you know, I really meant it. I really meant I'll never lie again. I just couldn't do it. I couldn't do it. I mean, for me, it was like telling the homeless guy, hey, homeless guy, just go get a house. You know? Just go do that. You know? And, you know, people say that to me all the time. Just stop drinking. Just don't lie. Just don't do wrong things. You know? Don't break the law. I'm like, I wish I would have thought of that. You know? But you know what? The draw to make myself feel better was stronger than the consequences of all the things I was doing, you know? And I continued, you know, to have things happen to me that are much like, you know, some of the things that have happened to you until the 1988, and it was me. And I was working, I moved back here, I followed a girl back here, and we got married. And I was working back at a psychiatric hospital in Reedley that I'd worked at before I went to the big place in Atascadero. And I was working with kids that had alcohol and drug problems. Yeah. Yeah, I was quite the role model, you know. Now, before I took the job, I stopped using all the drugs, and that was hard. I went back to NA meetings, I continued to drink. Okay, I had a baby. I didn't want to be a liar to that baby. I tell you what, every person in my life was not important enough to me to really do what I had to do, except for that little girl named Carly, who was laying in that crib looking at me. I knew that I had a sense of responsibility to her. And I tell you what, and this is no lie, I would have been willing to eat dirt to be a good dad to her. And that is no lie. I remember crying, you know, just saying, please help me be a good dad to this girl. You know, and I was able to stop using the drugs, but the drinking, I justified it. Well, it's legal, and I've progressed. I'm doing better, you know, blah, 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 all that other bullshit, you know. And finally, you know, and I'd work with these kids, and, you know, they were 14, 15-year-old kids. They were really messed up. They had it way worse than me. I mean, they'd been raped and traumatized and physically abused. They'd come from all over parts of the United States. I mean, horrible things that happened to these kids. They were actor-outers, boy. They were big time, and I was good at what I did. Aside from being a hypocrite, I really was a good counselor, and people recognized that, and they put me in the position that they thought I should be in. You know, but these kids knew that I was a liar, because they would say, much like when I bring my students over to Pine, you know, I teach at Porterville College, and I take my students over there for an internship, and I tell them, I say, the first thing that the guys at Pine are going to say to you are, do you use drugs? And they're like, well, what do I say? Well, I say, I don't know. Do you use drugs? You know? I mean, because if you do and you say you don't, they're going to know. And if you say it's none of your business, they're going to know. You know? And they say, well, what do I say, Mr. Stockman? I say, well, why don't you say I don't know you well enough to tell you the truth yet? That would be the truth. You know, start from there, right? But I didn't know that back then. The kid would always say, Danny, do you drink? And I'd say, well, you just know your business. You know, you're in the psychiatric hospital, not me. You know, let's talk about you, you know? And they would, I don't know if you know these kind of kids, but they would like to lose or, you know, they gave me that old look, you know, their eyes rolling back in their heads and, you know, that same look that I'd seen so many times. And after about a month of that, I was done. I couldn't take it anymore. I mean, I was losing control in the groups. The kids, I had no cred. Okay? No credibility whatsoever with these kids. And so I went to my boss, Paul, who was in the program as well, and I just walked in and sat down and I said, I quit. And he goes, good. I think, you know, you not drinking will probably really make you better at your job. So true. And I don't know, if you knew Paul, some of you guys do, he's in the program, he does this. You know? Well, that's good. You know, if you stop drinking, you'd probably be a better alcohol counselor, huh? What do you think, huh? Yeah? I thought I hid it pretty well from him, but evidently I didn't. The word has gotten out. I said, no, I don't quit drinking. I quit my job. And he did that again, you know, and he said, really? So you quit a job that you're good at, that you make good money at, instead of quitting alcohol? You see something wrong with that picture? And I tell you, honestly, for the first time, it's like, yeah, I guess that is pretty messed up there. Into that, huh? You know? And I said, I tried. I don't know how to do it. He goes, well, I'm going to put you on a leave of absence for 2 weeks, and I'll take you to some meetings. I probably should have gone to treatment, but I was too embarrassed and too ashamed. Probably should have. You know, so he just stayed with me, you know, and I stayed with him. He took me to a bunch of meetings over at St. John's, you know, that's where, you know, the regular meetings were back in 1988, and went with him, and I had a week of not drinking. Nothing. No left-handed cigarette stuff, none of that white powdery, you know, stuff that costs a whole lot of money. You know, no alcohol or anything except cigarettes. You know, and lots of caffeine. You know, and after about a week of not drinking, I went to a party with a friend of mine, Don, who I worked with, and they were serving wine, and I was just sitting there, and I heard people say, you know, one's too many, a thousand's not enough. I started hearing all the mottos, you know, and AA, but I was different, you know, and Don was like, why don't you just have one glass of wine? And that's all I'll give you. I said, oh, okay. So he gave me a glass of wine. The problem was is he never let the glass get empty. Every time he'd go by, he's filling it up. You know, and I'm looking, Nancy's going, you're drinking. I said, just one glass of wine. You know, it was never getting empty. Okay? I don't remember anything. I mean, this was really important for me to experience because I am a stubborn babau. That's a hardhead in Italian. I am a babau. Okay? But I start drinking this glass of wine, and next thing I know, I'm blacked out again. I don't remember a thing. All I remember is that, you know, I went home and I was naked. I went into the kitchen. I didn't get naked until I went home. That's okay. Okay. But I was laying in the, you know, Nancy said I was laying in the bed. I got up to go to the kitchen. I slipped, fell, hit my head on the counter. I was bleeding. She was holding Carly. Carly was 3 at this point. She called the paramedics. I was out, unconscious. And I woke up and the paramedics were working on me. You know, they had blood pressure cuff on me and stuff like that. And the first thing that I said when I came out of the blackout, which is a period of amnesia, I'd had many of those before, I didn't even know that that's what it was I yelled at her for overreacting. I mean, I am so ashamed of that to this day. You know, I mean, and I saw the look in her face, and Carly was crying, and there I am bleeding, and paramedics are working on me, and I'm naked as a, you know, a jaybird, and I am blaming her for overreacting. And think about how sick that is. That is really, really sick. That is really, really wrong. And I vowed that night, you know, that saying I'm sorry to her one more time wasn't going to be enough, that I needed to show her. And I needed to show Paul, you know, that I was worthy of the job. So I started going to AA meetings with more of a vengeance. And that was the last time I had a drink, and that was June 30th of 1988, you know. And it's... I appreciate the clapping, but, you know, me being up here on this podium and on this stage talking has nothing to do with it. I'm proud of my accomplishment. You know, I mean, the only reason I'm up here is because they told me at the very beginning that the way I stay sober is by sharing my message with somebody else, that was my job. You know, that it was no less of a job than if I was a diabetic, and they used to tell me this all the time from the old-timers. If I had diabetes and I had to go take insulin, that's what going to meetings was. That's what working the steps of alcoholics was. For the first time, I memorized the steps, but I had no intention of working them. I started working them. You know, and I realized, you know, that I was one of those guys. It didn't happen to me every time. I didn't have DTs. I didn't end up in prison. I didn't end up in any of the places that I've heard since I've come to AA, you know, but the truth is I felt like a hollow chocolate Easter egg. From afar, I looked solid, you know, but inside I felt like completely dusty. And I was sick of that. You know, I don't know that I was cooked all the way through. My suspicion is there might be some of you guys in here, you know, that might not be cooked all the way through, as I say. But I tell you what, here's what made me cooked all the way through was I didn't work the steps all my capabilities that first 6 months. I didn't drink. I didn't use any other drugs either. And, you know, but I got so depressed that one, I'd go to bed and I'd think about killing myself. The darkest days of my drinking were after I stopped. And that's the truth. And I didn't know it then, but I know it in retrospect, looking back there. I got so depressed. I did not like who I was. I did not like the life I had. I did not like the way that I thought people thought about me. And the only place that I got any, you know, what seemed like legitimate acknowledgement for being an okay person was in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I thought, well, that's pretty fucked up. You know? I mean, you know, I've worked pretty hard to be a good guy here, and I have to go to a room full of losers to get an applause? I mean, you know, what's up with that, right? But I didn't really get it back then, you know, and I got so depressed that the sponsor that I had at the time said, you know what, you might start working the steps as they are designed. You know, and he had me start reading out of the book, you know, and he talked with me about, you know, the promises. You know, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. It's not one of the promises, but, you know, it's attached to that. And he said, think about that. What does that mean? You know, half measures avail us nothing. One day at a time, this too shall pass. All those bumper sticker slogans that we've seen on bumpers forever, I mean, those were my mottos. I've never once in 24 years said I'll never drink again. I've never said that once. To my children, to my mom before she died, to myself. Because the truth is I bought into this thing that Alcoholics Anonymous was teaching me. And that is that I am powerless over alcohol, and I had plenty of evidence that when I started drinking, things happened to me that didn't happen to other people that drank. My wife still drinks. You know, she doesn't, you know, my wife is one of those that orders an expensive glass margarita. If she doesn't like the way it tastes, she pushes it away. You know, I mean, that, and just character-wise, I was different. And not just the drinking part, but I was also a liar. Because I'd drink that margarita anyway, and then after I drank it, complain about it, so I could get a second one. So, I mean, my morals were really affected, too, by my drinking. You know what I mean? So it really wasn't, you know, my disease of alcoholism isn't just about my drinking. My drinking sets off this domino effect of character issues in me that I really don't think is Danny Shakwa. I think basically I'm a good-hearted, sensitive, smart, you know, creative man, you know, who has this disease. And if I don't do things like what I'm doing tonight, if I don't sponsor the people that I'm sponsoring, although sometimes they make me just cry and sometimes they make me just want to kick their ass, I tell you, you know, because I want everybody to get it. I went back to school, you know, and I'll kind of wrap it. I went back to school using the principles that Alcoholics Anonymous taught me, that one day at a time thing, that this too shall pass. I had never finished anything that I had started. And I got turned on to school because somebody told me that education was freedom. I wanted freedom. I started going to school with two little babies. Now I've stayed married for 28 years. I went back to school. I got my bachelor's. I got my master's degree. And this isn't to brag. It's really not, you know. It's to let you know that the only way that I got those things was by using the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous. There were a whole bunch of times I wanted to quit, just like there's been a whole bunch of times I wanted to drink. A whole bunch of times. I can't tell you how many times that I thought, oh, sure it would be nice to have that glass of wine, you know. And then I think, oh, yeah, that's what I said that night at Don's. One glass of wine, right? It sure would be nice to do this. Now I'm teaching at a college. I used to get kicked out of colleges. It has nothing to do with me. Tony knows that. It has absolutely nothing to do with me. It has to do with what Alcoholics Anonymous has taught me to do. And I'd be really pretty foolish if I were to leave it, wouldn't I? You know, think about that. You know, there's been so many times that I've just thought, oh, I'm ready to graduate from Alcoholics Anonymous. I am done. 24 years of sobriety, I don't need this anymore. But then I remember a guy named Johnny Mack, who was a really important guy to me in these rooms here. And Johnny used to say, I keep going to meetings to find out what happens to people that don't. You know? And that's, you know, I so appreciate the freshness of your faces. you know. And I encourage every one of you guys, you know, at some point tonight to walk out of here really looking deep inside of yourself, you know, to find out, you know, are you where you want to be? You know, and if you are, if the answer is no, I'm not where I want to be. I'm not who I am, you know, who I want to be. I'm not in life where I want to be. I implore you to work the 12 steps to the fullest capability for 6 months. If your life doesn't get better, fuck it. Go back to doing it the way you're doing it. I mean it. I'm a counselor, too. I tell my young clients that all the time. Do it my way for 6 months. If your life doesn't improve, go back to do it in your way. You know what? I can say that with ease, because I know that if they do it thoroughly, their life's going to improve. It's not a risky statement on my part at all. You know, so my name is Danny Shakwa. You know, I'm a grateful dad and a grateful husband and a good friend to my friends, a good teacher, and a grateful member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you for letting me share.